The White House that President Trump has constructed has a lot of chiefs.
If she had become president, the world would still be this complicated.
This will probably get me in a lot of trouble, but I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry.
I've never seen anything like this. People just flat out lie.
Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week I'll be taking you backstage in a world disrupted. Join us every Monday morning for new episodes. Rate and subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast platform is. And do email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And now, this week's show. This week, a special episode, a well-timed conversation on the Democrats' post-Trump war within. A few weeks back, we did the same thing with Republicans, a party so divided we had to have two groups, one a set of Washington insiders, another of pro-Trump outsiders. Listening to them, you really weren't surprised to see President Trump and his emerging battle with the leaders of his own party the other day. He very much represents, as his longtime friend Roger Stone told us in that episode, the hostile takeover of the GOP. Well, this week's episode suggests, at least on the surface, Democrats are much more united. But then again, it seems to me that's really just on the surface, because they're united around hating Donald Trump. And that's easy for Democrats, but it's proving awfully hard for them to unite around something more than that. We'll jump right into it with a great group of Democratic leaders, activists, and thinkers who took the time to join us for this timely conversation the other day. We met in a restaurant near Capitol Hill. Tom Perez, the newly elected chairman of the Democratic National Committee, top advisors to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. We actually convened this group for the first time in the middle of 2016 to ask them the same question. What is the future of the Democratic Party? I thought it would be fascinating to bring them back together now that we're deep into the Trump era. Amazingly enough, I thought there were a lot of consistencies between the two conversations. But first, some introductions are in order.
I'm Neera Tanden, president of the Center for American Progress.
I'm Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University and editor of Dissent magazine.
My name is Mitch Stewart. I'm a partner at 270 Strategies and formerly the Battleground States director for the Obama campaign.
I'm Jess O'Connell. I'm the new CEO of the DNC.
And I'm Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC.
So, Tom, when last we spoke, we certainly didn't anticipate many of the events that have brought us to this, including the fact that you would be the next chair of the DNC. So I'm going to kick it right to you. When the late lamented Reince Priebus was, before he was White House Chief of Staff, he was chair of the RNC after the 2012 presidential election, and they commissioned, of course, an autopsy of what went wrong. Now, they then felt free to disregard its conclusions. is an autopsy in order of what went wrong for the Democrats in 2016?
Well, I think we have a pretty good handle on what has been going on, and I would expand the aperture of your question, Susan. It's not simply what happened in 2016, but what happened over the last 8 years that resulted in the loss of over 900 seats in state legislatures, the movement from 60 Democrats in the Senate to 48, the loss of governors and secretaries of state and state attorneys general, etc. That, to me, that's the question we've been focused on at the new DNC. And a big part of the challenge is we need a 12-month-a-year strategy. We stopped organizing. I visited an African-American church in Detroit after I took over, and a woman said to me, you've got to stop showing up every 4th October at my church and telling me that you care. And the new DNC, a big part of our rebuilding is that we have an every zip code strategy. We're out there 12 months a year, and we've changed our mission statement. Our mission statement is no longer simply to help elect the president of the United States, but it's to help elect Democrats from the school board to the Senate. That's why we've invested seven figures in Virginia, not simply to make sure that Ralph Northam and Justin Fairfax and Mark Herring get elected at the top of the ticket, but that we help people in the House of Delegates. We pick up 17 seats there in the House, we win. And when we are organizing, when we're organizing everywhere, when we're leading with our values, whether it's the Affordable Care Act debate, where we talked about how Democrats believe that health care is a right for all and not a privilege for a few, when we're doing things like that, and when we're out there in partnership whether it's the indivisible movement or whether it's the labor movement, whether it's Planned Parenthood or whether it's swing left. When we're out there with our partners, leading with our values, organizing 12 months a year, that's how we succeed. And that's what we've been doing, and that's the new DNC.
So, all right, I'm going to test this with the other members of this conversation. It's a little bit of a not technocratic solution, right? But you're certainly suggesting it's a difference in approach, not philosophy. Is that what ailed the Democrats, do you guys think, in 2016?
The one thing, I mean, it's heartening to hear all that, Tom, but the one thing that you're not talking about is what those values are, what the message is, what the policies are. I mean, I think the young folks who write for Dissent Magazine, my magazine, who work on it, you know, they're all Bernie Sanders people. You know, they really want a very tough progressive message. Obviously, that's not a message that will work everywhere in the country. But I think one of the problems that Hillary Clinton had and one of the problems I think Democrats still have is people don't really know what we stand for. I mean, general terms they do, but you know, there's certain things that we, you know, move towards, like $15 an hour and perhaps even single payer, though that's obviously a big struggle still. But I think a lot of people, especially the young activists who really are going to be helping the Democrats win next year and from now on, they really need to be inspired, you know, and I'm not sure that's really happening yet.
Can I just jump in with one anecdote, which is that when we have had unprecedented organizing over the last several months, we've worked a lot of people from the grassroots to Democratic senators, to Democratic House members worked to defeat the Affordable Care Act. And I was in several speeches and chants and chain-ins and sit-ins. And the people there are the new activists. And those new activists are often, are really primarily women, mothers. And I think the Democratic Party has to speak to all of the new activism, millennials, young people, people who feel like they've been left behind. But there are also a lot of people who feel like Donald Trump is an existential threat to their children and their families. And those are the folks who are flooding town halls and speaking speaking up for the values of a country and a party that is supposed to be about everyone, not just a few people. So I'll let Tom defend the values of the Democratic Party. But I think that what we lose sight of is the whole breadth of activism that takes place. We get lost in a debate between the Clinton and Sanders voters, and I hope sometime in my lifetime the 2016 Democratic primary will be over.
Right. I want to bring Mitch in here, but Neera, you brought it up. The 2016 primary is not
okay,
in
that
fact
that was
over.
Me not bringing it up.
You did, though. Come on. Just today, right, there's reports about this upcoming Hillary Clinton memoir and an early excerpt coming out in which she is scathingly writing basically, well, fine, but Bernie Sanders isn't even a Democrat. So first of all, have you read the book? And second of all, do you think it's going to divide the party even more?
I haven't read the book. I think, you know, Hillary has a right to discuss what happened in the campaign. But I actually hope that we can quickly move on to the fights in front of us.
Amen.
We have
lots of head nodding at the table.
We have, you know, what's happening to the Dreamers. What's happening in the budget, what's happening across the country where communities are really being torn apart by the actions of this administration. I think those are the issues that I hope we can move on into the future and that I hope will inspire a whole new generation of activists going forward.
Hope, maybe not experience, informing that answer. Mitch, I know you want to jump in here.
Yeah. So, you know, I've seen a lot of different organizing models based off of where activists or how activists come to those movements, and both aspirational, you know, for something or someone, and then also against someone or something. And in 2007, when I first started working for then Senator Obama, that was an aspirational movement. They were brought to that because of his personality almost more than his set of policy prescriptions, because a lot of people then projected their own policy prescriptions on him once he was elected. But that was a positive and sort of and you know, the volunteers and activists showed up because of him. What I think is unique happening right now, and I think this is a real gift for Democrats, is that the activism that I'm seeing is almost greater than anything I've witnessed before. Yeah, and it is everywhere. You could go into the reddest congressional districts, and Indivisible or another group could have a rally or a protest, and hundreds of people would show up. And what the unifying sort of thread through all of that is it's against Trump. And so you're seeing in a lot of congressional districts, whether it's special elections or whether it's town halls or protests, a lot of activism. And, you know, if you look at the generic Dem right now, I think it's +8 for Democrats on the ballot. So what I'm somewhat cautious about or nervous about is that's good, but that doesn't get us the House back. And it's a solid foundation for us to build a winning strategy, but it's not enough for us to have the real impact that I think we all want, which is to how do we put a stop to Trump? And to me, at least, you know, winning back the House is maybe the clearest way of doing that. And so for me, there has to be an and associated with where we're at right now. So we see all of this resistance movement, and it's really powerful, and it's organic, and it's everywhere. It's distributed. But we have to then parlay that activism into something positive so that we get from 8 points to 10 points or 12 points so we actually do win back the House. And that's going to be the missing key for us. And we have time to figure it out, not a lot of time, but and we're certainly in a strong position right now. We have a good foundation, but we have to do more, I think, as a party and say, what are people voting for in addition to voting against Trump?
The two big prizes for 2017 are New Jersey and Virginia. The last time Democrats won both states was 2005, and we know what happened in 2006. And again, past is not prologue, and we have a lot of work to do, and Mitch's point about putting forth our affirmative message is absolutely on the mark. What I've seen in Virginia, and I've spent a lot of time there, is exactly that is happening. We have a remarkable candidate for governor in Ralph Northam. We have a remarkable candidate in New Jersey in Phil Murphy. And they're not simply talking about Donald Trump. They're talking about what they're going to do. Ralph Northam's entire life has been a lifetime of service. Service to others. He's a pediatric neurologist, and he is talking about creating good jobs everywhere, creating pathways to opportunity, whether you live in Roanoke or whether you live in Fairfax County. He's talking about healthcare as a right for all and not a privilege for a few. And Eddie Gillespie can't even figure out whether he supports or opposes the Affordable Care Act. He's had a lifetime of service, you know, to the Koch brothers and to large pharmaceutical industries, and voters are paying attention, and they're paying attention in New Jersey as well. And that's why I think that we are poised in 2017 to replicate what we did in 2005. And this is a 13-year election, because whoever wins these races is presiding over redistricting. And we picked a lousy year as Democrats back in 2010 to get our butts kicked, because it has had a 10-year residual effect.
Can I just probe in, and this flows from that, to the Trump question, which obviously, you know, there's a backward-looking version of it, which is, was there too much focus on Trump to the exclusion of a message that people could get behind in 2016? But, of course, there's also the forward-looking version of that. Candidates in Virginia or New Jersey for governor won't directly face the issue of Trump, but those for Congress potentially will. And, you know, everyone here at this table will potentially face the question at some point of what should Democrats do and say about Donald Trump when it comes to the prospect of people already wanting to file impeachment motions, for example. How does the Democratic Party handle that? How do individual Democrats handle the politics of that? It's not up to you exclusively to define your agenda around healthcare, you know, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have to deal with the Trump elephant in the room no matter what. So I guess that's sort of the forward-looking version of it.
Well, I mean, Donald Trump and Eddie Gillespie and the Republicans in the Commonwealth of Virginia are the number one impediment to Medicaid expansion. Voters understand that. And so when they go to the polls, there's a lot of healthcare voters in Virginia. There's a lot of healthcare voters in New Jersey. And when you have a party whose belief is healthcare is a privilege for a few, like the Republicans believe, that has consequences. And so, again, I think we have an opportunity, and we have an opportunity to go into rural Virginia and tell that story. And that's exactly what we're doing, because Democrats all too frequently ignored rural pockets of this country. And that's a shame on us moment. And that's why we have an every zip code strategy.
One thing I'd say is, you know, I do think that the Trump presidency, even for the resistance, there is a pre-Charlottesville and a post-Charlottesville moment. And the Donald Trump's response to Charlottesville was, you know, a kind of extraordinarily shameful moment, I think, actually for the country, but also as progressives, it is really hard to think through how you actually talk about like a tax plan or something with somebody in that response. But I think the way I think about this is that so far, Trump has done everything he could possibly do to pit Americans against each other, to sow division, to fuel distrust of American against American, almost, you know, to adopt a kind of Bannonite strategy of fueling racial antagonism, xenophobic antagonism against Dreamers, et cetera. And I think a core principle of the Democratic Party has to be a defense of equal rights for every American. At the same time, when you look at the election, and not just the 2016 election, but the elections to come, Democrats have to do better than we did in 2016 in communities, in rural communities, where people feel like they've been in a slow burn recession or depression for years, not just months. And so, you know, from my perspective, we actually have to have a stronger, bolder economic message for those folks, not just for white working class voters, but for people who don't go to college, who are white, black, Latino, or wherever. We have to communicate that we care about Detroit and Appalachia, and people suffering in both are a problem for the country and a problem for the Democratic Party, not just one or just the other. And I think Trump wanted to use this campaign to basically say to a lot of folks that liberal elites hate you, and we have to show a bolder economic plan than we have before, one I think that needs to be focused on jobs, that communicates to those voters that we do care, that we care as much about their success as any other success, anyone else's
success. Okay, so you want to talk about jobs, but do you want to talk about Russia? Are you going to be able to avoid talking about Russia? You know, like that's
See,
really the question.
I do think the issue is that we have learned with the peripatetic. I thought I'd just get pathetic in there on that song. President, that you can do a lot of different things. And, you know, my own view of this is that we saw throughout the month of July that people can focus both on a challenge to our democracy, which is what happened in Russia, as well as healthcare for millions of people. And, you know, I do think progressives have to learn to walk and chew gum in the Trump era, but they're doing that.
I think we're forgetting the one thing, though, is that we're talking about message and process, which is a very Washington thing to do. But the Democratic Party as an institution, you know, as you all know, doesn't really exist in Southwest Virginia the way it does in Alexandria, Virginia, or in D.C., you know, where Hillary won 93% of the vote. So I think part of the problem is not just the message, but who is presenting the message. I mean, we have people like the governor of Montana, Steve Bullock, you know, who clearly, you know, understands in this overwhelmingly white and Christian state, you know, how to talk to people. I worry that we are, you know, looking out at America from our liberal bastions still. And that's true with Russia, too. I mean, you know, what happened with Russia, as far as we know, is terrible, and we don't know the bottom of it. But in the end, I don't think most Americans are going to vote Democratic instead of Republican because of Russia. And of course, even if somehow Trump is impeached, which I think Republican Congress will never do, we'll probably have a more efficient, much worse president to replace him.
So I just need to jump in here and say that, I mean, I hate to say that not everything is politics, but not everything is politics. And if, you know, if I think it's an incredible assault on democracy happened, I hope Democratic office holders, be they Republican or Democrat, Democrat with a small D, office holders would actually respond. And I actually disagree slightly in that if you look at public polling, independents care deeply, and it has been a deep weakening of Donald Trump amongst traditionally conservative voices, independent leaning, that is, been really concerned about Russia. But even if it polled at zero, I think people should actually, and I hate to lecture a professor about this, but I think people should actually do the right thing, which is defend your democracy against a foreign adversary's
aggression. Of course, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying, I think...
Well, but it's interesting on the politics, though. I mean, did the Democratic Party benefit from Watergate? Well, right?
They did.
Yes, the answer is they did.
Yes, they did.
Mitch, I do want to give you a chance to jump in here, both on the Trump question, which is how much is uniting around a message of this is not the president we want going to be inevitable regardless of the politics?
Yeah, so I have a unique perspective on this because in 2009 and 10, I was the national director at Organizing for America, and we had a front row seat at the 2010 elections. And it wasn't a surprise. Like, we had the research, we saw the polling, and we predicted that we would lose the House 3 months before the actual election. And so it was like this slow-moving accident that you couldn't get out of. You were stuck in the car. And, you know, one of the reasons that was so successful for Republicans is it was a national election. We were trying to localize it, and Republicans were trying to nationalize it, and they were successful, and we were not. I suspect that that same dynamic will hold true in 2018, or at least I hope it does. I hope it's a national election and not a localized election. I think that benefits Democrats. But one of the failures I had in 2016, like thousands of failures, in what I thought was going to happen with that election, but certainly the biggest for me personally was I had a lack of imagination of how bad we could do with some of these white working class voters. I assumed that Barack Obama was the floor with those voters, and that the diversifying of the electorate plus having that floor would provide us with a pretty steady foundation moving forward. And I was wrong. And what I'm afraid of us as a party, and maybe this isn't true in 2018, but it certainly can be in 2020, is that we think the floor is right now. Was to say it couldn't get worse. Why can't it drop another 5 or 10 points in some of these places? You know, Donald Trump lost states that look like America. He lost Virginia. He lost Colorado. He lost Nevada. He won states that don't look like America. You know, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania don't necessarily look like America if you look at the, sort of census statistics. And so there's a host of states like that where, you know, if we lose the industrial Midwest, you know, our only play then there's like North Carolina, Florida, and then waiting for Arizona and Texas, which will eventually turn blue. But, you know, how do you catalyze or quicken that process? So I am concerned, and I do feel like we have to come up with some type of message. And I think it's an economic empowerment message that shouldn't be geared just towards white working class voters. It should be geared towards everybody, because I think it impacts everybody. But we have to have a positive message that talks about how we're going to improve the economic lives of voters, period.
But again, I agree with what Mitch has said. At the same time, I think it goes beyond message. We've got to show up. We've got to be present. We've got to have an every zip code strategy. I traveled around this country over the last 7 or 8 months, and I went to rural Wisconsin, and I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and I'm proud of that. I often have said I don't have a PhD in economics, but I have a PhD in Buffalonomics. And you know, Buffalo is a wonderful union town, the city of good neighbors. And I got married in Wisconsin, and I spent a lot of time in both states. And we can win both states, but it starts with having an every zip code strategy. I was in Northwest Wisconsin, Dave Obey's old district. Traveled there in earlier this year, and I met a guy who drove 4 hours to this town hall meeting. We thought 40 people would show up, 150 people showed up. And he said, you know, I feel politically homeless, Tom, because the Democratic Party hasn't been here. And that is a shame on us moment. You look at the data in Ohio. Hillary Clinton was competitive in 2016 in the Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus metro corridors. She lost Ohio largely because she got clobbered in the rural counties. And again, we can't simply focus on the 2016 cycle. We've got to focus on this issue. And the reason why message is important, but infrastructure is equally important, is because if we're not there talking to folks in Roanoke about why the Affordable Care Act is really important to them, well, then we're not going to be competitive in Roanoke. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. This ain't a sexy job. You know, but when we'd love to talk the whole time about messaging and what we have to stand for, and that is important. But if we ignore the conversation about technology infrastructure and about organizing infrastructure and about voter protection infrastructure and about all of those core elements, you know, millennial engagement, next-gen infrastructure, we're going to continue to leave opportunity on the table. And that's what we're focused on, is not only the message side of this, but that infrastructure building. That's what we're doing in Virginia right now and in New Jersey. And we won special elections this year in places we have no business winning. We have two special elections in Oklahoma for state races where, you know, DNC investments helped to elect Democrats in districts that Donald Trump won handily, and that's we have to scale that.
But the thing is, I would just say is I think just to say it a little bit, I totally agree. I mean, I agree with both sides of this. It's infrastructure, but I also think we have to recognize I wouldn't call it message so much, but answers for people. So I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at what's happened in a lot of these communities. If you just pull out white non-college people in the country have had a hard time moving up over the last several decades. Other groups have moved up, not mostly because we've had a civil rights revolution, which is all to the good. I think the challenge for Democrats is that there has been a right-wing noise machine that basically has told these voters that liberal elites hate them, and that helped move the numbers up. But just as a reminder, Obama won all these Midwestern states in 2012. So the issue is, how do you get to a place where you're doing better with those voters? And I think the issue for us in front of us is Trump is dividing people against each other. He's going to try and sow racial division. So you have to figure out an answer. And I think really the only answer for the Democratic Party or for progressives at large is to have an answer about how people who haven't gone to college, who haven't had a lot of things given to them in life are going to do better year after year after year. And I think we have to have a bolder answer on jobs. You know, Cap put forward an idea about a Marshall Plan for jobs, meaning you take just a fraction of the tax cut money and spend it on actually employing people to solve the country's problems on infrastructure, childcare, healthcare, education. And I think, you know, but we have to have solutions that actually answer for folks how they're going to do better years from now, and their kids are going to do better in communities that feel like left out of the conversation in the country.
That brings up the problem that Trump did put his finger on, was why he won these Midwestern states, is because he said the problem is the elites, and the problem is people the problem is foreigners, is immigrants, is aliens, and that's an old strategy, as we know, going back to George Wallace, going back to the 19th century as well, and. Yeah, and it's very tough at a time when, as Neera said, these older white working class people have not done well. In fact, they've done worse than they did, and they have no hopes for their children doing much better. And there's this division between people who go to college and don't go to college. All these things we know. I mean, I think you said Trump's dividing us. Yeah, but people already divided. You know, Trump just expressed that division, and we have to find a way to. You know, within a very heterogeneous party, even though we're in the minority, we're a much more diverse party, of course, than the Republicans are. You know, how do we both talk about universal programs, have a universal message, and make sure we're talking about recent immigrants and non-immigrants, African-Americans, Latinos, LGBT people as well? I mean, to me, that's a serious problem.
And by the way, I should note that this was exactly – it was the conversation that we had last year in this group before the election. So even though none of us anticipated the ultimate outcome, I went back and looked. And here's what Mitch said. More than a year ago in this group. No, it's good. You were being very hard on yourself because you said I didn't get, you know, how out of touch we were. But actually, Mitch, what you said in that conversation was the big thing that I'm frustrated with was that I feel like our message to white working class voters is the same message that we've had for the last 30 years, and it hasn't worked. We keep losing them. And by the way, this was just in June of last year at the end of the primaries. And so Do we keep saying similar things or repeating things that we know are in their economic interest but frankly haven't translated into support? Neera, you responded and you said, okay, well, but I have, to be honest, some reactions on multiple levels here. Are people really reacting to changing economics, or is it also changing demographics? It's a lot easier for us to say it's about economics and not to address the part of Trump's message that might be about immigration or demographics or race than it is about the economy. And I'm struck by the fact that immediately in 20 minutes, we're right back in this group today to that question. Is it about economics, or are we looking at something different that's dividing us? And the Democratic response to that obviously would depend on what your analysis is.
I'll just say very briefly, I think when you, it's really hard to unpack. I mean, we've done a bunch of analysis of the 2016 elections, and you can say people are, there are a lot of poll questions where it seems like people are responding to changing, you know, I think a euphemism would be culture. And a lot, there are lots of ways you can see that it's race, I mean, or it's economics. One example is that when you look at the counties that moved Obama-Trump, a lot of those counties have a high proportion of jobs that can be outsourced. I think it's really hard to know whether people are more open to racialized messages or racist messages if they're economically struggling or not. I mean, that's a kind of metaphysical question. From my perspective, though, I just don't think it's easy for the Democratic Party, or really, truly, to be honest, the right thing to do, to tailor your message to people who have racial animosity. But again, Barack Obama won in 2012, and he won these states. And there are Obama-Trump voters that it seems to me possible to get back. But our hope really is to have a stronger, bolder economic message for them that actually isn't the same message of the last 30 years. I completely agree with you. Is something that is more concrete about how your life is going to be tangibly improved.
I mean, and let me put my labor secretary or former labor secretary hat on for a moment here. I mean, income inequality is one of the defining issues of our time. You look at the post-World War II period. For the decades following World War II up until 1980, when you had wages and productivity going up hand in hand. Workers helped bake the pie of prosperity, and they shared in the spoils. And not coincidentally, that's when we had increasing labor union density, because the right to organize, America's greatest generation who fought in World War II, came home and led the labor movement. And then starting around 1980, we started to see the flattening out of wages, and not coincidentally, the attacks on the labor movement. You started seeing lowering of labor union density. When you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu, my friend Lee Saunders has said, and he is correct. And we've seen this over a 40-year period. When I was a kid growing up in Buffalo, if you were a baggage handler for Eastern Airlines, you had a middle-class job. Now you go work for United Airlines, they outsource it. So you're making a minimum wage because they thought that that would be a smart move. It was a dumb move, actually.
What do we do about that, though, is the question.
Well, actually, places like Southwest Airlines, you know, baggage handlers are actually middle-class jobs at Southwest Airlines. And you know what? They've been the most profitable domestic carrier over the last 15 years. And so the dam broke in 2016 for a lot of folks because they were feeling this decades-long angst. And Barack Obama did heroic work saving us. We were at the precipice of a Great Depression, and he was able to pull us out. But we had a long way to go. And so I continue to believe. And Trump has cleverly put fear on the ballot and fear in the eyes of folks. And my parents taught me that if you blow out your neighbor's candle, it doesn't make your candle shine any brighter. And I continue to believe that we are better positioned than any country on the planet to lead in the 21st century. But we do have to be bold. And actually, our platform as a Democratic Party is pretty darn bold. And folks from Senator Sanders' coalition and Secretary Clinton's coalition came together around that platform. But we have to fight for the right to organize. We just passed Labor Day. And you know, again, this every day should be Labor Day. We have to fight for the basic proposition that apprenticeship is a wonderful ticket to the middle class. When we're fighting for things like paid leave, we're the only industrialized nation on the planet that doesn't have some form of paid leave. These are not bold ideas elsewhere in the world. And I think when we show voters in every zip code across America that we're fighting for them, I mean, Dr. King said, you know, if what good is a seat at the table, you know, if you can't afford to buy a hamburger?
Okay,
I think that's a message that resonates everywhere. And we have to boldly put that forth, and we've got to organize around it everywhere so that people understand in Wisconsin or in the heart of Baltimore what we stand for.
And the tactics matter, too. I mean, we've talked a lot about the organizing, we talked about the messaging, all of which are correct. But the second piece of that, one that we're focused on at the National Party, is technology and data and infrastructure. I mean, this is an incredibly important part of winning campaigns and electing Democrats. And we've been woefully outspent by the Republicans. They spent $175 million since 2013. The Democratic Party hasn't seen a technology investment in a decade. Okay, so there are tactics around the work that we're doing, regardless of message, that we've got to get done, and that is the neighbor-to-neighbor communication and the boots on the ground, reinvesting in state parties and doing the organizing, but also a massive investment in technology and data so that we can meet people where they are and have those conversations.
Okay, so Mitch, catch us up, though, on the demographics aspect of this. I mean, how much do you think that Obama was holding back the tide of change that was going to break against Democrats? Or was the previous view basically correct, but you had a flawed candidate, right? If the previous idea was actually Republicans are on the wrong side of demographic history, and, you know, you can see this Trump election as sort of a yawp, you know, a last ditch standing athwart history saying no, you're suggesting that maybe that's not the case, and that maybe it's Democrats who could still fall more.
Well, so I think during Obama's years, we had somewhat of a bipolar electorate. So in 2008, the electorate looked much different than 2010. 2012 was much different than 2014.
And the reason for that swing, just to be clear, is because Americans participate at such low levels that the turnout can change dramatically.
So in 2016, I don't feel like turnout was the reason that Secretary Clinton lost. I think it was more about underperforming specifically with a group of voters that we've been talking about. And not really underperforming, maybe a little bit with African-Americans, but I think she did better with Latinos than Obama did. So it wasn't really a turnout game, I don't think. I think it was specifically with this cohort of voters, white working class voters without college degrees, where Democrats suffered. And it wasn't just Secretary Clinton. I think it's easy to sort of second guess the strategy. Democrats across the country lost those voters. We lost them in Wisconsin. We lost them in Iowa. So you had Russ Feingold, who's long, you know, been seen as a champion for working class people, get beat in Wisconsin when he was leading up until about 2 weeks before the election, or at least close. So it's not just the Secretary Clinton problem. I think it's a Democratic problem. And one of the things I wish we would focus more on, we've had all kinds of activism. We've had marches for science. When in a million years would you think that there would be hundreds of marches across the country to support science? But we've had it. You know, what we haven't seen, though, are demonstrations or protests around job site closings or other things that are really going to impact working class people. Take your racial identity out of it. Just people who rely on these jobs that are somewhat disposable or they don't feel are super secure. And I wish we could focus this energy, this activism, on an issue that I know really resonates with people, so it does show that we're fighting for them. So it does show these, you know, these values that Democrats that we have, but right now we're sort of almost playing into the stereotype that Trump is painting of us, and it's a concern I have.
Chair Bratton,
I guess what I'd say is I think this is an important, that the healthcare fight was an important fight on many levels, but I do think their activists and progressive leaders were basically arguing to defend the healthcare of millions of people who were mostly, just be 100% candid about this, mostly people in rural communities. I mean, that healthcare bill that they dreamed up had the worst, most miserable pain for rural, middle-aged, low-income folks, and was actually easiest on upper-income millennials in cities. And I think that fight did become a fight where a lot of progressive leaders could say, you know, I am here for this basic thing, which is that you should keep your health care And you should like not be subject to the whims of a Congress that wants to rip this health care away from you. And it was really a lot of activists who saw it in those terms. But I take your point that on some of these issues, I mean, it can kind of seem far removed from bread and butter topics. But as we go through the Trump administration, you have to recognize that for all of his rhetoric during the campaign, his administration so far has been a war on working class people of all colors. You know, I mean, from the budget to tax policy to health care to executive actions against overtime to a whole range of things, undermining unions. This has all been a giant bait and switch for him. He talked about reigning in Wall Street and helping working class people, and he's been attacking working class people and giving Wall Street a just massive free load on
Chairman Paris. It's easier to bash Trump, isn't it, in some ways than it is to get everybody on board with what the message should be.
Well, you know, we've worked very hard to make sure we're communicating our inclusive message of opportunity in every zip code for everyone, a brighter future, better tomorrows, and a better deal for everyone. But, you know, it's undeniably challenging when you have someone announcing North Korea policy via Twitter and his own, generals learning it via Twitter at the same time. That's undeniably dangerous. And that is why, you know, we will continue. And again, it's been one of the best things that I've had the privilege of doing was hiring Jess O'Connell, because we have to do everything that we're talking about and then some, because if we don't build this infrastructure of success, I mean, think about what Jess just pointed out. $175 million since 2013 spent by the Republican Party on technical, the RNC on technology infrastructure. And, you know, we weren't keeping up, and it has consequences. One area where I want to respectfully take some issue is I hear frequently, and I don't think it's in this debate, but I want to make clear, I hear frequently from folks that we either have to focus on white working class voters or focus on the diverse tent that is the Democratic Party. And I could not categorically reject that proposition more strongly. I firmly believe that our message of inclusion and opportunity resonates everywhere. When we talk about healthcare as a right and not a privilege and the impact of the repeal efforts, that resonates everywhere, because everybody in every zip code has benefited in one way, shape, or form. And frankly, you know, in terms of underperformance, I think we have all too frequently tended to take some of our core constituencies for granted. African-American women, for instance, are the most loyal constituency of the Democratic Party. And we need to do more to make sure that we engage them, that we don't take them for granted. We need to be there. And again, I keep thinking about that woman I met in Detroit shortly after my election, who said, "You got to stop showing up every 4th October." One of the things we're trying to do is take the word off year out of our lexicon, because we've tended to be an accordion as a party. We expand in the presidentials, we shrink in between, and we scratch our head and wonder why we lose midterms.
All right, Michael, has the chairman of the party convinced you?
Not really, not yet. I mean, look, I want him to. I mean, part of the problem, I think, is we have to talk about what are the inclusive programs that we're going to be pushing. What's the inclusive conversation we're going to be having? Because we are a divided country. We've always been a divided country, but even more divided now, thanks to Trump and a lot of other things as well. I mean, I think the root of working class is work, you know. And Sherrod Brown, Senator Sherrod Brown, as you know, has a really big program about how to reinvent work. We have to think about what the future is going to look like for people. People are afraid of robotization, they're afraid of globalization, they're afraid of all these things. And Trump's solution to that is shut the borders, America first, everything's got to be made here, which is, of course, not realistic. And his own companies, everything's not made here at all. But I think we have to engage in issues that do cross these boundaries, demographic boundaries. And one is, what is work going to look like in the future? How are Democrats going to be able to give people a sense that they're going to have good jobs, or if they don't have good jobs, maybe they have to have universal basic income. You know, we have to have a longer discussion about the future. This is not just an intellectual exercise. You know, it's an exercise about giving people hope. You know, one of the smartest things a guy named Gary Young, a journalist, writes for The Guardian, said about the 2016 election. I keep remembering it. He said, Donald Trump gave his people reason to fear. Hillary Clinton did not give her people reason to hope. And that's what one of the things Obama did, whether, you know, with vague abstractions or not, he gave people a sense to say that, in fact, Democrats could address, you know, the future. And I think that's, you know, one of the things we haven't quite done yet. Opportunity, yeah, but everyone talks about opportunity, right? You have to put flesh on that.
I think, you know, I would just say I agree with Tom that this is a very false debate between defending civil rights and this. And anyway, we're not going to have a choice because Trump is going to continually attack Dreamers or voting rights or something else. And parties are called on to defend core principles. And if we didn't, you know, people shouldn't vote for Democrats to begin with. But I guess I would say one important thing to go forward is, look, we don't have great answers to what jobs will look like in 10, 20, 30 years. And I think it's right for people to have some anxiety in a world where driverless cars are going to take over. Like, how are you going? And it's not really, how are you going to have a job in 10 years? And how are your kids going to have a job in 10 years if you haven't gone to college or had a lot of, you know, hand-ups in the system, basically? I think that Democrats have to think through answers we haven't in the past about how we're going to create those jobs, how we should restructure the entire tax code. You know, should we have things like a payroll tax when jobs are so scarce? They weren't, you know, basically the architecture of our employment law, tax law, all these things are from the 1930s. And I do think the one benefit of Donald Trump, which is not worth it, but one perverse benefit is he has widened the scope of things that we should discuss. Yeah.
No, and there's a ferment, right?
Yeah, clearly that new ideas needed. And I think the candidate, I mean, I'll be Pollyannish, I think the candidate in the candidate 3 years from now who has the best answer of how we're going to have jobs into the future and how we can actually do that will do better in the process than anyone expected.
I said this as a joke to a couple of my colleagues, and they didn't laugh, so I'm going to repeat it with, I assure you, going to be the same response. I feel like some of the debates that we're having right now around work, if you watch Game of Thrones, are similar to, like, you know, the fights that we're having in Westeros, you know, between, like, these, you know, families that have been fighting for thousands of years.
Who's the dragon? Who's the dragon?
Well, I'll get to that. So from my perspective, AI what's coming down the pike are like the White Walkers that are going to be like busting through the wall and like change everything dramatically. And we're having like these old fights that aren't going to be relevant in 10 or 15 years because just the whole scenery is going to change. And I agree with you, Nira. I hope whoever our nominee is in 2020 has at least some foundation how to address that, because right now no candidate, at least my knowledge, is really addressing it, except for a cap. I'm sure that the cap they are.
But, all right. Well, I'm not sure Mitch got any laughs with that, but he certainly got a lot of vigorous head nodding. So it seems like agreement. So we got to finish with a final lightning round. I think that the question of 2020 is one of the things. So, okay, three very short questions for everybody. 2020 contenders right now, you know, we're talking about a list that seems pretty familiar and backward-looking in some ways. So, you know, who are some names that you all can surface, number one? Number two, will Donald Trump serve out his entire term in office? And number three, what is one word for the state of the Democratic Party today?
I'll start, I guess. I think there's going to be like 25 people or 30 people or 50 people running for president in 2020, because, I mean, I think a lot of people, just to be candid about it, are like, if Donald Trump can be president, so can I. And I think there's a whole crop of new generation of people who aren't on the tip of anyone's tongue, just like Bill Clinton wasn't on anyone's tongue, just like a lot of people didn't expect Barack Obama to take off like he did. I think you'll have a lot of new people running, and there are obviously a lot of fantastic people who've run before or are standard bearers for us. So I think there's just going to be a ton of those people.
Number two is will Donald Trump serve out the remainder of his term? And number three, one word for the party.
Uh, I hope not, is my second. And then on third, revitalizing. Like, I do see a firmament that's changing the party as we speak.
So I won't be shy saying I think we need a figure like a Sherrod Brown or maybe Al Franken. You know, they're white guys, it's true. But or Elizabeth Warren. I mean, someone who can talk in more inclusive ways about jobs and about work and about the future. Will Trump survive? I have a bet with my wife, actually, that he will. And whoever wins gets to take the other one to their favorite restaurant. So I either way, I win.
So you're a winner either way.
Either way,
yeah,
I win. Exactly. But, you know, I hate to say I kind of hope so in the sense that, yes, he'll be terrible. But, you know, I want the Republicans to remain divided. It's not good for the country. But I think in the end, I want people to realize what a terrible guy this is. And I'm afraid that that's not going to happen if somehow he resigns or somehow gets impeached and we have Pence instead. So and last one word, reinvention, recreation, revitalization. They're all good words. Yeah, but they all begin with the same prefix. So.
So I agree with Nira. I think there's going to be 20 to 25 people who not only seriously think about it, but actually run. And so what I think is going to be interesting is that both during the Iowa caucuses and maybe even New Hampshire primary, you might have the winner with 15, 16, 17%. We haven't seen that since, I think, Jimmy Carter in 76, when I think undecided actually was the winning caucus number, and Jimmy Carter was like second. So that will just be interesting. And the other thing I'll say is I don't think Bernie Sanders, if he decides to run again, will have as much oxygen as he had in 2016. There's going to be a lot of other, I think, powerful people that will compete for that same space that he had basically to himself in 2015 and 16. I don't subscribe to the notion that, and so I'll disagree with you a little bit here, that like Mike Pence is going to be a worse version or more efficient version of Trump. I think Trump is as low as we can go. I don't know if impeaching, I don't know if he'll be impeached or if he'll serve out, but I don't subscribe to the notion that like Mike Pence would come in and be like a super efficient conservative president. In fact, I think he has a lot less appeal than Donald Trump does with those specific voters. And then my word is renew. I'm optimistic about the future.
Jess, I know you're going to have a word that doesn't start with an R-E, but...
True.
I
am counting the days to support any Democratic nominee against Donald Trump in 2020.
How surprising.
I am also counting the days for Donald Trump to be gone. I don't know when that will be. I think it's way too unpredictable to speculate on that. And I'm taking three words. Organizing to win.
The chairman gets the last word here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again. And, you know, I'm going to make sure. I back in 89, there was a lot of hand-wringing and bedwetting among some. Oh, my God, who will emerge in 1992? And we had a bumper crop of candidates that emerged. And there are some remarkable people here in D.C. and state governorships and mayors and others. And we're going to have a robust field. And what we're going to do at the DNC is to make sure we create a level playing field for everyone and move forward in that way so that we have a fair and open primary process. The most important thing for me, Donald Trump is an embarrassment to our nation. I mean, there's every single day you see something else that is an embarrassment to our nation. And I think the most important thing we need to see right now is to make sure that Director Mueller's investigation can proceed unimpeded. And you will see, I'm confident, more and more efforts behind the scenes by Trump because he's unencumbered by anything to go after Mueller. And now he'll do it indirectly through surrogates. And we can't allow that to happen because it really is an affront on our democracy. And we really do need to move forward. I'm optimistic about our future as a party. It's about winning. That's the Democratic Party. If I had to do one word, winning. We need to win elections because one thing I've learned is that when Democrats win, good things happen to a lot of folks. And when we don't do so hot, we see a lot of chaos and carnage. And that's been the story of 2017. So we're building to win, and we build to win by making sure we put our values out there in a very clear way, and we communicate that optimistic vision. I am, notwithstanding that Rome is burning and it's a five-alarm fire, I am chronically optimistic about our future, because the energy, and I get back to Neera's point at the outset of this conversation, the energy that's out there, and Mitch underscored it, is palpable, it's unprecedented, it's organic, and our challenge is to take that moment, turn it into a movement. And I get back to what I said, that movement translates to victory, so winning. When we win, good things happen.
Well, I got to thank you. I have to say, this is probably the first time any of us have seen the unique combination of optimism and Rome is burning in the same sentence. So, you know, I say the other takeaway for all of us is that it's pretty hard to escape from that one word, which is Trump. That we can talk about artificial intelligence and the future of work, but it does circle back to this particular unique historical moment we're in. And nobody's going to come away from this thinking that elections don't have consequences anymore. But I want to thank everyone here. This has been a really uniquely thoughtful and engaging and stimulating conversation. I know the listeners of the Global Politico will enjoy it. And of course, I want to thank not only all of you for being here today, but all of our listeners. They can listen to us on iTunes or whatever is their favorite podcast platform. And of course, you can always email me at sglasser@politico.com. I get lots of great ideas and feedback amazingly from these listeners. And so thanks again to everyone here and to all of you.